Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. Papal audience. Pope Benedict speaks about St. Paul's teaching on the relation between Adam the first man and Christ the second Adam. Rich in relics, Rome abounds with relics, and we look at some of the most popular and curious examples in the Eternal City and find out why relics continue to exert such a fascination in our modern times. And unwanted daughters, we find out how millions of baby girls are going missing in India due to the growing practice of aborting female fetuses because of the traditional preference for a boy. Here in the Vatican, Pope Benedict continued his catechesis on the teachings of the Apostle St. Paul, focusing on the relation between Adam, the first man, and Christ, the second Adam. Emma McCarthy has this report on his Wednesday general audience.
In his continuing lessons on St. Paul in his Wednesday audience, Pope Benedict dwelt on the Apostles' teaching on the relation between Adam, the first man, and Christ, the second Adam.
Paul's teaching on the sin of Adam and its disastrous consequences for the human family is meant to emphasize the surpassing gift of grace bestowed on humanity by Jesus Christ. Seen in this light, the doctrine of original sin explains the misery of our human condition, yet Paul also underlines the moral responsibility of each man and woman for this tragic reality. All have sinned, the Apostle tells us, and all fall short of the glory of God.
In comments in Italian, Pope Benedict developed this theme, reflecting on the apparent paradox of the existence of evil, even if the desire to do good seems omnipresent, even in politics, where everyone claims to want to create a just world. This contradiction, explained the Pope, is the sense of original sin, a concept that is still valid today, even though some theological currents have their doubts. The presence of evil in the human heart and in history is undeniable, affirmed the Pope.
The new life and freedom which we have received by the grace of Christ impels us to bear witness to the sure hope that all creation will be freed from its bondage to corruption and share in the glorious freedom of the children of God.
Then, in his greeting to separate language groups at the end of his catechesis, the Pope reflected on solidarity to those homes and families worst hit by the current economic crisis.
Saluto i rappresentanti della Banca di Credito Cooperativo dell'Amentino.
In greeting a group of Italian bankers, he said, "This period of difficulty for so many families gives me the opportunity to highlight one of the primary objectives of banking institutes, that is, solidarity towards society's weakest and support for small companies." Concluding, Pope Benedict invited all pilgrims to pray that Christ come in this Advent season to overcome violence and injustice and help us all become makers of peace.
Upon you and your families, I accord and invoke an abundance of joy and peace in our Lord Jesus Christ.
Fragment from the true cross, a nail from the crucifixion, the blood-stained bandage of Padre Pio, the skull of St. Agnes, and the finger of St. Thomas the Doubting Apostle. These are just some of the examples of the incalculable array of relics that can be found in Rome or elsewhere in Italy. Relics have been venerated since the very earliest days of Christianity and are divided in three classes, with the highest class reserved for those relics that are actually a physical part of the saint, such as a bone or a hair. A second class relic is something owned by a saint, whilst the third-class one is an object that has touched a first- or second-class relic. Contrary to what many people believe, the Catholic Church does not claim that relics have magic or special powers, but rather sees them as a way to come closer to a person who was deemed holy and thus form a closer bond with God. And despite our modern high-tech society, relics continue to enjoy great popularity among people of all ages and all countries. This was shown very clearly after the death of Pope John Paul, when there was a massive demand from the faithful for acquiring fragments from one of his cassocks, despite the fact that he is not yet a saint. But why do relics exert such a fascination, even amongst non-believers? And is the veneration of relics a macabre superstition, as many modern Christians claim? Well, to find out more about Rome's treasure trove of relics and to get the answers to those questions, I spoke to Liz Lev, an expert on Christian art and archaeology at Duquesne University's Rome campus.
Well, I think the interest in relics is something that every human being can one way or another relate to. I mean, you remember the first flower your husband gave you. You remember your lock of hair of your child from the first haircut. Or even, you know, in a very modern sense, you have something like the Hard Rock Cafe, where you have these instruments, these objects that belong to people that we've admired or enjoyed or derived pleasure from. So the idea of holding on to a moment in time or to a person is a very universal sentiment.
Nonetheless, there are many modern Christians who claim that this veneration of relics is a macabre superstition. What's your answer to that?
Well, it's a funny division. It seems that if you're making a keepsake of an object just for memory's sake, everybody accepts that as perfectly normal, even if it's an autograph of a television star from a series that's long been off the air. But when we talk about an object that somehow links to a supernatural presence, the object of someone who, a belonging of a person who lived on earth historically and that we now know is in heaven, it's that supernatural factor that seems to put off, frighten, startle, or discombobulate even many people who are very grounded in a rational, scientific view of Christianity.
Nonetheless, it should be remembered also, in fact, that the Church itself doesn't claim that relics have magic powers, does it?
Well, the Church has never claimed that relics have magic power, simply because magic is something that is always controlled by man. What we talk about always in the Church, we don't believe in magic in the Church. We believe in the grace of God. We believe in that which God is capable of doing, and particularly through the saints who have followed his will, lived in his grace, and led these exemplary lives. And so to have an object, something that links us to this person who lived an incredible life and made it to heaven, that idea is what the Church promotes.
Now, another popular misconception, although of course it did happen in the past, is that relics cannot be sold. There is actually a canon law, isn't there, governing their treatment?
Well, in the post-fall world, once you have something that is attractive to people and that people desire, immediately there will be abuses of the question. So we find the earliest church fathers dealing with false relic sellers. We have St. Augustine warning about characters who are running around selling bones, animal bones, as relics. And it's been a long-standing problem in the Church to try to eradicate people who take advantage of people's desire for relics, either by selling them — relics are not to be sold — or purporting completely false objects as relics. And as more people began to take interest in the cult of the relics, obviously more abuses took place. And ultimately, we have several moments in the history of the Church, particularly in the Councils of Trent, when a simple ban on sale of relics, any form of, quote, filthy lucre, should not be attached to them. And then we find even in canon law today that it is absolutely forbidden and wrong to sell relics.
Despite it all, there's a lot of popularity. You know, these relics have an amazing popularity, and we've seen that even over the last few years. And when there was this massive interest in obtaining threads from one of Pope John Paul's cassocks.
Oh, well, yes. In the particular case of John Paul II, or another very good case of this, is Padre Pio. The interest in relics of Padre Pio is immense. But in the case of John Paul II, whom we all know will become a saint, and this desire, this wait, this eager anticipation for the day when we can all celebrate the canonization of John Paul II and see the church recognize him in heaven, there's already this anticipation and getting little bits, sort of being ahead of the game, if you will, kind of getting into the advanced sales before Christmas, if you will. So getting these little objects, these little pieces of his cassock to be able to feel closer to this historical presence. If you think about it, how many people met John Paul II? How many people knew John Paul II? How many people's lives were affected by John Paul II? And now, how many lives will be affected by John Paul II's intercession in heaven? And so having that little channel, that little object that is part of his earthly presence, that somehow allows one to feel close to his heavenly presence. These things have been exploding. The request for relics for John Paul II has turned into thousands upon thousands upon thousands in these last few years.
Now, you mentioned there, Padre Pio, that there was the viewing of his body this year. And then back in 2002, there was a bandage with bloodstains from his stigmata that was brought to Rome for the first time, which attracted an amazing amount of interest among the faithful, didn't it?
A tremendous amount. My memory of the arrival of the relics of Padre Pio in Rome was that the relic of the glove went to a church up slightly outside the city, not a very big church, not very big enclosure. And obviously expecting there to be a few curious, interested people in this day and age, a few faithful. And the church found itself overwhelmed with visitors, spilling out in the street, causing traffic on Via Aurelia. The amazing response of people to come and see this remain of the stigmata, I mean, our stigmatist of the 20th century. Really, it's remarkable how, even though it seems that we want to push away this notion of supernatural, and yet there are millions upon millions of people who are still interested and want to feel close to this phenomenon, which is outside the realm of our eyes and our touch.
Let's turn to Rome now, which of course is a city that's particularly rich in relics. For instance, the Holy Cross in Jerusalem Basilica, this has an amazing collection, fragments of the real cross, a nail used in the crucifixion, two thorns from the crown of thorn of Jesus, to name just a few.
Right. It's a very important site for remembering very specifically the Passion of Christ. And looking at those relics, which are displayed in a marble room with a sort of coldish atmosphere to it, completely lined with marble, and you feel as if you're in a tomb. And against the far wall, you have the cross of the, you have the wood of the cross, the piece of the headboard, the nails, the thorns, this accumulation of objects that remind us of the very real historical and human suffering of Christ. And it's a very good way to close that gap between that day in 33 AD and our day today by realizing, you know, this really happened.
And I read that the hearts of many past popes, and indeed other internal organs, are stored at the Church of Saints Vincent and Anastasius near Rome's Trevi Fountain. Why is that?
Well, one always hopes to be fortunate enough to live in an era of a sainted pope. And in preparation for that, I think the church already prepares itself for relics. We have the cassock of John Paul II ready to go. We had the hearts of these great popes. And so something always there so that we can connect ourselves back to these historical figures even as time passes by.
That's also, I read the relics of many other, perhaps not quite so well-known figures like St. Agnes, the martyr, her skull. That's got quite an interesting story, her life is, and her martyrdom, right?
St. Agnes. Well, St. Agnes is one of our great Roman martyrs. I mean, she's a great martyr for a number of reasons. One, because she was a young girl. She was the sort of person in Roman society of the 4th century AD. Nobody would have given her a chance. She was destined for marriage. She had no particular authority, and yet she found in herself the strength through cooperating with the grace of God and her faith to defy the Roman Empire. And her long, drawn-out martyrdom, flames, attempted rape, attempted humiliation, and ultimately the decapitation shows how this young woman resisted and resisted and resisted. She's a magnificent martyr. And where did all this happen? It happened in the heart of downtown Rome, in everyone's favorite sitting room, the Piazza Navona. So in that same site where today we get ice cream, we take our pictures, we enjoy seeing the painters working, is that site where this brutal, brutal witness to faith on the part of this young woman. And her relics in particular, I mean, her church, her catacombs, the catacombs where she's buried, were so inspirational that the emperor's own daughter wanted to be buried by St. Agnes, so Costanza, the daughter of Constantine. So we've seen in her case, and in the case of many other martyrs, our Lawrence, our Cecilia, these tremendous witnesses to be, to see, to touch that memory is always a very stimulating thing, even to the Romans today.
Right, talking of martyrs, and of course it's very apt because we're celebrating the Pauline year, there's also, isn't there, some relics of St. Paul?
Oh, well, that's the most thrilling question of 2008-2009, the Pauline year. The tomb of St. Paul has been found. It's in the place where it was always believed to be, in the Church of St. Paul's outside the walls. The slab of marble put into place in the 4th century AD that says Paolo Apostolo Martire, that's been found, right down to the holes cut in it to let down the little brandelli, the pieces of cloth to make relics. And now we wait with bated breath to see if indeed inside this stone enclosure at the very core of the basilica, if we will indeed find the bones of St. Paul as they did the bones of St. Peter 50 years ago.
That would indeed be a very precious relic. Now, you mentioned earlier, of course, the duplications, the counterclaims, the claims, the fact that so many relics being sold down the history were false or likely to be false. Can you think of some of the most glaring false relics, the most notorious cases?
Well, there have been some pretty wild claims for relics. I believe there was some of the darkness from one of the plagues of Egypt, which was kept in a church in Rome for a while. There was the foreskin of Christ, apparently was a relic kept in several different places.
Although I read that the Vatican was unhappy about this particular veneration and forbade any mention of it.
These are a number of kind of over-the-top creations of relics that came about during the years. There are some relics that have been seriously questioned, not least of which is the fragment of the column in Santa Prexede. It has been called into question for many, many years because it doesn't appear in history until the 12th century, when it happens to be the family of the Colonna, which means column, that crop up with the column of Christ. So some of these things are more than a little bit suspicious.
And sometimes the sheer quantity, I mean, for instance, the fragments of the real cross, sometimes you must wonder whether all of them are genuine.
We are not the first to wonder about the extraordinary number of fragments of the true cross. And as a matter of fact, the people who first seriously began to question the authenticity of all the fragments of the true cross claimed to be in various places around the world were the Bollandists, who were formed in the late 16th, early 17th century. And they set upon themselves to catalog all the relics in the world with a particular interest in the fragments of the true cross. To date, they have not found enough pieces to make a single cross.
That's interesting. Okay. Finally, what's your favorite or most inspirational relic, if you could tell us, and why?
My favorite relic in Rome is in the Church of the Holy Cross of Jerusalem, built by St. Helena in the 4th century AD. It's right there with all the other objects of the Passion, the true cross, the nails, the thorns. It's the finger of St. Thomas, the finger that a doubting Thomas insisted that he would not believe in the resurrection of Christ until he put that finger in Christ's side and felt his wounds with it. And I think that relic is a very good way of understanding our relationship to relics in the church, in that Thomas, like a normal human being, wants to use his senses to understand. He wants to see, he wants to touch, he wants to feel, he wants to know empirically. And Jesus understands it without even Thomas even having to ask him. Jesus approaches him and tells him to feel with his own hands the wounds. Christ understands our doubts and our uncertainties. But at the same time, as Thomas verifies with his own eyes and says, "My Lord and my Savior," Jesus reminds him, "You have seen and you have believed, Thomas, but blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." And I find that a very good way to go through the question of relics.
I was speaking there to Liz Lev, an expert on Christian art and archaeology in Rome. In India, becoming pregnant with a baby girl can have fatal consequences. Such is the traditional preference for a boy that millions of female fetuses are being aborted, and the number is rising each year. Some commentators have called it a silent but massive suppression of human life on a scale that is almost akin to genocide. Girls in India are often viewed as a burden, not least because tradition demands that a girl's family provide a dowry for their daughter's marriage. A practice that continues today even though dowries have been ruled illegal. Another factor that helps explain why so many unborn baby girls are not living to see the light of day is the growing use of sex determination scans for pregnant women. Here again, the practice is illegal, but the law is widely flouted. Often when the parents discover through the scan that their unborn child is a girl rather than the longed-for boy, the decision is taken to abort the fetus. As a result of this growing trend to abort the female child, the ratio of girls to boys is dropping rapidly throughout India. In 1991, there were 945 females to 1,000 males, but 10 years later, that had dropped to just 927 females. And in some states, such as Punjab, the number of females being born compared to males is dramatically lower. The Catholic Church in India has spoken out strongly against the practice of female feticide and has earmarked the 8th of September as Girl Child Day to help persuade parents of the equal worth and dignity of both boys and girls. The church says girls are not just being selectively killed in the womb in India, but in some extreme cases are left to die after birth. In addition, girls are often neglected or mistreated throughout their childhood and then by their husband's family when they marry. Cardinal Oswald Gracious is the Archbishop of Bombay and the president of the Indian Catholic Bishops' Conference. He calls the selective abortion of baby girls in the womb a diabolical practice.
I think it's because of the whole idea that the girl is a second-class citizen. We are trying to fight against that forcefully. You see, traditionally, a girl in many places was considered a burden, partly sociologically because economically she had later on take dowry, etc. Therefore, families did not consider it a blessing when a daughter was born, but it was a blessing when a son was born. Now, with the possibility of determining the sex of the fetus, people have got into the idea of female feticide. And this, as you can see, is diabolical because it's not only taking life, but also taking life selectively of women.
But how many baby girls are being aborted each year in India? And where is the practice most common? Well, to find out more, I spoke to Sister Lily Francis, who heads the Catholic Bishops' Commission for Women and Children.
Around 500,000 female fetuses are aborted every year.
And where is the practice most prevalent?
It is practiced in Punjab. For every 1,000 boy children, they have only 300 girl children in some part of Punjab. But even Delhi, it is affected. Delhi ratio, as per the census, 808 girls for 1,000 boys. Also, we see the third child in the family, usually the ratio goes much, much low. 300 and 12 girls, 4,000 boys.
So in many areas of India, there's now a very distorted ratio and a glut of boys in a way.
Yes, yes.
Maria George Loy is a Catholic sociology student in New Delhi who has done research into the practice of female foeticide. She spoke to me about the widespread bias and discrimination against females in Indian society that help explain this growing trend to abort baby girls.
I think the reason why it is increasing is that women are constantly being considered as a liability in India, because of factors such as dowry, and women are considered as a liability because of the dowry amount that has to be paid when they get married, and because they are getting married to a family that is outside, the woman does not prove as an asset to her own family in which she was born.
Experts say that although Indians know that female foeticide is being widely practiced thanks to the growing availability of sex selection scans, people don't like talking about it openly. And in many of these cases, the pregnant woman is being forced against her will to abort her unborn baby girl because of pressure from her husband and his family. There are some cases where the pregnant woman will rebel against this pressure to abort her baby girl. But as Loy explains, when women do this, they run a serious risk of being badly beaten by either her husband or his family.
Women, when they rebel, they are battered, they are pushed and they are kicked so that the child somehow is aborted.
So you're saying that if the woman does not agree, violence is likely to be used against her?
Yeah, if she opposes that, yes, I will have my child against the wishes of the family, she is battered. Many succumb to the pressure, and even if the child is allowed to live, she is not looked after properly by the in-laws, or the woman is not encouraged enough to educate the child, or she's not given the means to educate the child or to look after her properly.
Despite the worrying statistics, Cardinal Gracious says he hopes the trend towards aborting more and more female fetuses will diminish eventually, as people come to realise the implications of this practice.
I think that as people get more educated, as people get more enlightened, as people the world is becoming more and more a little village, people see the role of women in society, I am hopeful that this trend will gradually begin to diminish, and I hope it will die out completely.
There's a saying in Indian society that raising a girl is like watering a plant in your neighbour's garden. With attitudes like this, there's little wonder that so many females in India are being denied the right to be born. But, as Loy reminds us, it's difficult to change deeply rooted attitudes and traditions in a hurry. Happily, as Loy herself made clear, she does not share the bias against female children felt by so many of her compatriots. Let's end with her views.
This attitude does prevail, and I think it has nothing to do with education as such. It is a mindset that has been inculcated in the people, something which is widely said around, that the girl child is a liability to the family.
Are you married?
No, I'm not married.
But when you say were to get married, I assume that you would be fighting very strongly for the right for any girl child that you were carrying to be allowed the right to be born.
Yes, definitely. I would love to have a lot of girl children, and I will definitely fight for her rights.
I was speaking there to Maria Loy from Delhi, and you earlier heard the voices of Cardinal Gracious, Archbishop of Bombay, and Sister Lily Francis. Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.